Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day.
In 1912, Lawrence, Massachusetts was one of the textile capitals of the world. Half of all the city's residents over the age of 14 worked in the mills.
One of them, the Giant Wood Mill, was the largest cloth-producing factory on the planet. It employed 40,000 workers.
And they came from more than 30 countries and spoke more than 45 different languages. And they worked in hot, dangerous, deplorable conditions, as recounted here by actors reading oral histories in the video Collective Voices.
Mills were damp and hot and noisy. The looms and machines were lined up row after row. The mill owners would speed up the machines. We had to work at two or more machines at a time.
We had to pay the foreman 10 cents a week to get clean water to drink.
We had to move as fast as the machines, and they weren't safe. Accidents happened all the time. A lot of people lost fingers and arms. Our hair got caught in the whirling bobbins. The air in the mill was filled with dust and bits of thread. It was hard to breathe. It made us sick.
And then on January 12th, 1912, some 25,000 workers walked off the job.
Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.
Well, 100 years ago, the bread and roses strike drew the nation's attention to the working conditions in the mills of Lawrence and to the concentration of wealth and power in the United States. Today, we'll look back at the historic Lawrence strike and how it echoes today in a time where the Occupy movement is again trying to call attention to income inequality. Joining me now in the studio is Robert Forant. He's professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, as well as the chair of the Bread and Roses Centennial Committee. Professor Forant, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Also with us today from Portland, Maine, is Ardis Cameron. She's a professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine and author of Radicals of the Worst Sort, The Laboring Women in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Professor Cameron, welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure to have you. Bob Forant, let me just start with you. Why is it, you're the one who actually has been quoted as saying that the Bread and Roses strike was Massachusetts' first Occupy movement. Why do you say that?
Well, I think that once the walkout began, it became impossible, if you lived in Massachusetts and eventually throughout the country, not to read every day about the strike, about what was happening, about the poverty, about the living conditions, the working conditions that the strikers had been faced with. And so it put in front of the nation this question of what our economy was like, what our industrial revolution at the turn of the 20th century was like. And if you couldn't ignore it, you could try to deny the truth, but you couldn't ignore it. So in the same way today that the Occupy movement made people, made the political campaigns, made the country think about inequality, the strikers did the same thing.
Well, Ardis Cameron, you know, when you read about the conditions that workers and residents of Lawrence were living in at the time, it's almost impossible to imagine. So take us back and describe to us what effect did this burgeoning industrial economy have on the lives of the workers there? What was it like to live in Lawrence in 1912?
Well, it's interesting in terms of comparing it with occupied America because, as Robert points out, the strike of 1912 really was a tipping point in many ways. It was one of the first major strikes that was picked up by the national press in a sympathetic way because it did expose the kinds of conditions that all of the workers were struggling with, and the conditions were really horrendous. I mean, the average age, once you walked into the spinning room, the average age was about years that before mortality was 7 years. You could survive 7 years pretty much in a spinning room because of the high humidity, the horrible conditions, the poor water. Mm. The Merrimack River was polluted. People lived in very crowded conditions. In fact, they were more crowded than in Calcutta, India.
In Lawrence, Massachusetts. And we heard those actors reading those oral histories a little earlier. These are vast, vast factories we're talking about with tens of thousands of people, many of them women and children. Tell us about the child labor that was going on there at the time.
And child labor was very, very typical during this time period because even if both parents worked, there was not enough income to support the entire family. So parents had to bring their children into the mills to employ them despite the laws. And the priests were very culpable in this. They helped them forge their identity cards or their birth certificates so that children 10 years old and 11 years old could enter the mills and be, argued that they were really 14. Mm. So, you know, again, that wasn't because parents were cruel. It's just that they needed every little hand, every cent to make ends meet in these kinds of conditions.
Regarding the adults who were working in the factories, I mean, one of the most distinguishing things is, A, many of them were women, and B, it was basically almost all immigrants.
The city of Lawrence had attracted massive numbers of immigrants. A lot of mill cities in Massachusetts did during this time period. You could look at Fall River, New Bedford, Holyoke. They would be somewhat similar, but Lawrence seemed to draw more and more people. Employers actually sent recruiters to European countries, essentially with the streets are paved with gold sort of mythology.
Yeah,
I've seen
posters apparently they put up in
European
cities.
Yeah, there's money hanging
cities,
off trees and things.
Workers
and so,
walking out of factories with bags of money in their hand.
Yeah, and so, but at the same time, once people got here, I mean, just some other to add to what artist Cameron was saying about the living conditions and such. Lawrence had, of the sort of 10 worst cities in the country, Lawrence ranked in the top 10 for infant mortality, for mortality under 5, and for just mortality in general per 1,000 people. So it was a really difficult place to live. The other cities on the list in the top 5 happened to also be Lowell, Fall River, New Bedford. So if you were a textile worker in Massachusetts in this time period that we're talking about, your life was grim, nasty, and probably short.
Artist Cameron, tell us, you've written a book about the women in particular who were working in the mills. Tell us more about them, because they were absolutely central to the Bread and Roses strike.
They were indeed. Keep in mind that the strike began because the wages were being reduced, the numbers of hours, I should say, were being reduced by the state legislature from 56 hours a week to 54 hours a week.
And so, ironically, this was done as a progressive movement,
it was a progressive,
I guess,
Governor
to protect
Foss signed
women and children.
It was, in a sense. I mean, Governor Foss signed the bill because he really wanted to run for president, and he thought this would really be a progressive act to show his support for the union movement. But there was no compensation for the wages that would be lost during that reduction. Hmm. And so a number of unionized workers, highly skilled workers like the mule spinners and others, made their own agreements with management. So the fear of a strike had really pushed away by really January 10th, January 11th, no one thought a strike would happen.
But just to sort of put more granular detail on this, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're talking about workers who at that time were already earning only, what, $6 to $8 a week?
Yes, yes. The average for women is around $6.20 per week if they were working full-time. But the problem was they weren't always working full-time. So that was another component to this.
And even with the reduced number of hours from 58 to 50, or is it 56 to 54 hours, a two-hour reduction.
56 to 50 hours,
yeah. They were still expected to keep up the same productivity.
That's right. They're also expected to swallow the reduction in wages. Mm. So it was really on Thursday when the Polish women in the Everett Mill discovered their paychecks were short, that reduction had taken place. They weren't sure that would happen. They were furious, and they dropped their aprons, they picked up their picker sticks, they walked through the mills, they took their kids, grabbed them, walked out of the mills and shouted, "Let's go, this is it, we're not doing this." And they went back into their neighborhoods in the plains of Lawrence, and it was like electricity going through the neighborhoods because these women had walked out. That night was really full of meetings in the corners, in the grocery stores, and that was the beginning of the strike. The next day, 20,000 people, you know, turned up. It was huge.
Artist Cameron, stand by, because I want to throw a question to our listeners. I mean, when you hear that a strike that began on January 12, 1912, drew eventually 25,000 workers into the streets of Lawrence, Massachusetts, and ended up having a profound effect on labor history, what do you make of it? Do you have family stories? Maybe your grandparents or great-grandparents knew about the Bread and Roses strikes. What did they tell you about it? And what does that strike have in terms of lessons for Massachusetts today? And when you hear that immigrants who spoke some 45 different languages came together around a rallying cry, does that make you think that maybe the so-called 99% today can also come together? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob Forent, so artist Cameron has told us what precipitated the strike. What happened then, though? The backlash was fairly quick.
The militia, the mayor was at first of the opinion that he could keep order, but quickly it became apparent there weren't enough police officers, so the militia, so he petitioned the governor to send the state militia, the National Guard in terms of what we would call it today. And so fairly quickly, several regiments of the National Guard showed up in Lawrence. One of them, interestingly enough, was Harvard students who were let go from their final exams if they wanted to go to Lawrence and police the strike.
Apparently they were given credit for doing so.
They were given credit, yep. So, and interestingly, too, in Boston labor history, the Harvard students also show up during the Boston police strike in 1919, keeping order in downtown Boston. So yeah. The militia came fairly quickly, made it really, really difficult for workers. The initial sort of way workers struck was they blocked the front doors of mills, and eventually the militia decided not to let workers congregate in front of the mills. So for one of the first times, as I understand it, in American labor history, a moving picket line began to form. And at one point, when you read the newspaper descriptions, there were anywhere from 7,000 to 10,000 people in picket lines marching all around, up and down to all the mills in Lawrence in a very sort of moving, obviously very powerful procession.
Artist Cameron, let me ask you, I mean, I guess I'm going to play momentarily the role of the speaker for the side of industry here. I mean, the textile industry was so massive in Massachusetts that the thought of 25,000 workers walking off the job, I mean, they had the power to paralyze the mills of Lawrence. So, I mean, the harsh and severe response from employers seems almost expected.
Well, it was expected. Labor had been brutally attacked on a number of occasions. There was a strike in Lawrence in 1909. There had been strikes earlier, the Ludlow Massacre. I mean, there was always a huge backlash to these events. The Lawrence strike was also critical because the woolen mills was a trust company. The American Woolen Company was actually a trust, and they owned and controlled most of the woolen textile manufacturing mills throughout New England. So whatever happened in Lawrence was going to reverberate across that region. So it was a very critical moment that everyone understood this was going to be the real battle.
Now, you actually are one of the few people who have spoken with women who were members of the strike, and they have some amazing stories. I mean, you have one story of Syrian workers who were telling you how they would carry red pepper under their skirts in order to face the police.
Well, I did. I interviewed men and women during the strike who were involved in the strike. I interviewed them from 1979 to about 1984, and most of them were in their 80s and 90s. And yes, some of the stories they told were quite incredible, and family members had never heard these stories. There was a lot of silence about the strike in the years that followed, in the 50s and 60s particularly. But yes, one of the women I interviewed, she was maybe 4'2", and she was with her grandchildren and her children. And she talked about how when the cavalry came, as Bob mentioned, they were on horseback, and they were often Harvard students, but they were also trained militia. By the way, the Wellesley girls came to town, too, and they worked in the soup kitchens to help the strikers. But these people were on the streets with no weapons at all, and these cavalry officers had not only guns but batons and large, huge horses that were very, very intimidating. So this one woman told the story about how underneath her cloak she carried red pepper, and that had been passed around by the Syrian community. I think this woman was actually Italian. And she had to jump up, she was so short, and throw that into the nose of the horse. And that made the horse rail up. And why he did, the cavalry officer then was thrown off the horse. And then what would happen is the women would circle around the fallen cavalry officer, and they would strip him, ritualistically strip him down to his underwear, his long johns, and boo and hiss and shout and laugh and make fun of him as he was running out down the streets. And it was a way to shame him, and it was the only weapon they really had. They didn't have guns, they didn't have weapons, they didn't want to use them, but they were attacked fairly violently. In fact, I found many of these women's names in the records not only of the police and the records of the newspapers, but in the hospital records where they've been taken for treatment.
Artist Cameron and Robert Ferrant, stand by. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us, talk about Lawrence history, to talk about the Bread and Roses strike 100 years later and what it tells us about working in America today. Let's go to Salem, where Jessica's on the line. You're on the air, Jessica.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's your thought?
I've read Artist Cameron's Radicals of the Worst Sort. It was one of the best history books I've ever read. It was fantastic. And what really struck me was the multicultural diversity of the Lowell community. Mm. That it was Italians living next to Jews, living next to Syrians, and you never really hear about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting, one of the recordings that I had listened to, somebody who had interviewed immigrants in the 1960s, he was a young boy in school, and he asked this one woman in Lawrence, he said, so you must have lived in an immigrant ghetto, you know, using that term. And she said, oh, yes, we lived in a ghetto. She was herself Jewish. She said, above me was Italians, below me were Syrians, next door was a German-Austrian woman. So a whole different notion of what a ghetto meant to people who lived in this very heterogeneous, polyglot community.
Well, let's get a call on that point. Leo is calling from Shirley. You're on the air, Leo. Leo, are you there? Hello, Leo. Can you hear me? We'll try and get that call back. Artist Cameron, let me ask you, if it was so polyglot, how is it that the workers during the strike were able to communicate to each other and actually work in concert?
That's really one of the interesting things about women, because they were involved in traditional responsibilities of food preparation, cooking, laundry, and childcare. And they lived in these tenements. Now, keep in mind that on the shop floor, the men, as well as the women, but the workers themselves on the shop floor were separated by ethnicity. They were paid different rates. They were more easily controlled if they were separated. Mm-hmm. So it was the women performing these traditional female responsibilities that allowed them to overcome those differences and talk to each other in ways through taking care of each other's kids when they're sick or had to go to work, helping to prepare food together. In fact, one woman who was Italian told me that she used to cook for her husband Syrian food because she had learned it from a Syrian neighbor upstairs, and her husband never knew how she learned it.
Bob Ferrant, ultimately, Congress and the America as a nation focused in on the strike as it was going on, in part because of all those child workers who were in the factories in Lawrence. That got the president, William Taft's, attention at the time. But ultimately, tell us, there's just so much detail in this, but what happened at the end of the strike? What brought the strike to a close?
Well, the city fathers are upset with the fact that strikers are gaining publicity because they're sending children away from the city to homes where they'll be cared for during the strike. As Artis said, people are living close to the edge when they're out of work so many weeks. There's no money. People don't have a bank book or a credit card. And so there are sympathetic families in Barrie, Vermont, New York City, Philadelphia, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And children start to be sent in early February. And as that happens, the strike starts to gain more publicity as well. When they get to New York City, there's parades and whatever. And so the city finally decides, the militia finally decides, that they're going to not let kids leave anymore.
So they essentially arrest
on a Saturday. So the kids are leaving, and then they say, no more kids leaving. And so on a Saturday morning in late February, a bunch of kids are at the train station, about 40 kids ready to go to Philadelphia, and the militia and the police sort of ride in, and essentially there's a melee at the train station. Clubs are thrown, people are hit, women and kids are thrown in wagons and brought to jail and are arrested. And that gets even more publicity. The headlines in all the newspapers the next day on Sunday and then on Monday are just catastrophic for the mill owners. It's just incredibly bad publicity. That gets the attention, as partly I understand the story, at least, of the president's wife, William Howard Taft's wife. And eventually then Congress has hearings, and a number of these kids go to Lawrence. Camilla Tioli, one of the most famous of the really young people who testifies, is 14 years old. She's badly, badly injured in the mill, has half of her scalp taken off in a machine. Her testimony just blows people away, and that really begins to put pressure on the mill owners to settle.
And ultimately, the mill owners do settle. They agree to an increase in pay. They agree to overtime, I believe, and to not retaliate against workers.
Eventually, they do, sadly. A few months later, they actually do retaliate. By October, things are really rough and tumble again. But at least for a time, this is a real important, significant win for labor.
Artist Cameron, we're really running down on time. I'm just so sorry to say, because it's such a fascinating conversation. But if I could bring it back full circle, first of all, do you think that the what happened in Lawrence 100 years ago is taught adequately in this day and age? And what do you think the actual lessons are for those who would look at the Occupy movement?
Yeah, no labor history is taught adequately in America. Probably no U.S. history is taught very adequately. It's very hard to get these stories into schools. It's hard to get these stories into the community. In terms of lessons, I think it's interesting to make that comparison, as Bob does, because if you look today at where the top 10% of Americans control two-thirds of the American net worth, that's very similar to what it was in 1912.
Well, that's Artis Cameron. She is professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine and authors of Radicals of the Worst Sort, The Laboring Women in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Artis Cameron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Bob Forent, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Lowell and chair of the Bread and Roses Centennial Committee. Great to have you as well.
As always, a pleasure.
I should say that there's a year-long celebration going on in Lawrence as
well. Yeah, we opened the exhibit this morning. There was 104-year-old man there who was alive during the strike and was one of the children sent to Barre, Vermont.
Wow. Well, there's information about the centennial celebration and an online exhibit, a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. Well, coming up next, the brilliant and tormented Mark Rothko paints the Boston stage with red. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.